We wanted to crawl back in time. Even then, we were only 5, but that wasn't young enough. The more we played this game, hovering outside our parents' door after dinner, trying to hear their mysterious bedroom sounds while pretending we didn't, the more we wanted to be babies again, or even to slip back into our mother's belly, the way we slid into her bed those nights when Dad was away on a hunting trip. "I'm 5 years old," we said. "How old are you?" "I'm 5 too.
Sharon, this is your debut novel, but it's not your first book. I understand you wrote a memoir before this. How did that change for you, writing a memoir and moving to a fictional piece?
Well, I have my MFA in fiction, and I was actually had finished the story, the short story that grew into this novel before I started my memoir. So I consider myself a little bit of an accidental memoirist. And I think most memoirists would tell you that when you publish a memoir and the people who are the characters read it, there's also this extra layer of your nervousness about how the reception to the book will be, because you're wondering, you're writing about real people and you don't want to hurt them. So that's definitely something I grappled with, the whole ethics question, when I was writing my memoir. And it's kind of a relief not to have to think about that extra layer when publishing a work of fiction.
You don't have people reading it and saying, "Wait, isn't that me?"
No. You know, I intentionally made them pretty exaggerated. And the story has a mythical element to it. Some of the characters kind of fashion themselves as godlike. So it would be funny if people did think that was them.
I'll touch on that a little later to ask you about these mythical names. But before we do that, in order to entice people to pick up this book, Half, can you give us a short synopsis of what it's about?
So it's about 2 twin girls who are so close that they're virtually one person. They have the same thoughts, they do the same things, and they speak in the same voice. They speak in a unified voice for parts 1 and 2 of the book. And then in part 3, that voice breaks in half. And that's really the main dramatic tension of the book. And readers know it's going to happen, but they don't know how it's going to happen. And so that's, I think, where the drama comes from. The book, it starts with they're 30 years old and they come back to Michigan for their father's funeral. And they haven't talked to him since they moved away to college. It's a terrible kind of complicated grief that they're experiencing. And they feel culpable and they feel compelled to relive their childhood to see what went wrong and whose fault it was. And so we see them as these 30-year-olds who have 5-year-olds themselves going back in time and revisiting together in one voice their childhood, starting when they are 5 years old themselves, and then coming back all the way until they're 30 again. So it's a little bit of a murder mystery, but it's also about family dynamics and the intense fierce love that everyone in this family has for each other, how that love counterintuitively kind of leads them to all betray each other. But I do think it ends with some hope that there's a sense that they're coming into their own voices and their own identities is both a sad thing, but also an inevitable thing and a part of growing up. It's what growing up is finding your own identity and separating from others. So I like to think it operates on lots of levels that even people who aren't twins can identify, because it's really about intimacy and closeness and how close possible to be with someone, and how much that love is both very rich and satisfying, but it can also be heartbreaking.
Being identical twins, you hear a lot about that twins can be very close and intuitive about each other, but your twins actually can read each other's thoughts, at least at the beginning. And I love the way that you use we as the narrator that eventually becomes I and I, and that's part of that technique of separation that you use. When you started writing about twins, was there something in your own background or your closeness to a sibling? How did you imagine the world of twins to be?
Right. And one of the first questions people usually ask me is, are you a twin? And I'm not a twin, but the story was inspired with my close relationship with my brother when I was growing up. He's a year and a half older than me. And we actually, the opening of chapter one, I have the twins having this conversation of saying, I'm half years old. How old are you? I'm half two, meaning 6 months old. These five-year-olds pretending they're babies. And that is something that my brother and I used to say to each other. That's kind of the seed of the book. It started with that remembered conversation that these children who are young but want to, they're nostalgic for an even younger age when everything was simpler, and they're kind of clinging together, the two of them, because the world is scary. They hear sounds and they don't know what they are, they don't understand. And I remember that feeling of being a child and the world feeling scary because there's it's hard to tell what's real and what's magical. And also, my father died when I was 7, my brother was 8. So we had this trauma and found each other as support and comfort when it was really hard to show anyone else what we were feeling, even know ourselves what we were feeling. We didn't have to explain anything to each other. We could just be with each other as if, you know, we just understood. And that to me felt kind of like reading each other's minds, though we didn't literally. And so I wanted to take that feeling and kind of make it literal, which you can do in fiction, even though it's not possible in real life for people to read each other's minds. It's kind of a metaphor for what I think what a lot of people do have when they have these close relationships.
And then adding to that magical, mystical element that weaves through this book, as you mentioned earlier, you chose mythical names, and the figure of the father is godlike at times. He can change the weather. He can do these magical things just by thinking them or wishing them or commanding them to be so. Talk about that element.
Yeah, and that kind of comes from my life, too, because since my father died when I was so young and I didn't get to know him the way that I would have otherwise, he's become kind of a mythical figure to me, and I've kind of made up or filled in the blanks. So I took that idea of you know, a father who is a mythical idea, and again, kind of made it literal. In the book, it's not, you know, I like to play with the idea that maybe he's has some supernatural powers, maybe he doesn't. The question is, like, what's magic and what can be explained through science and through possible biology or mental illness. But I do think there are a lot of larger-than-life figures and a lot of men, even in the news today, who have this magnetic quality and who have a lot of power and who seem to feel like, at least, like they are in control of the world. And so that's a reflection of, I think, what's kind of going on in our politics these days, too.
One of the things that you take on in this book, and since you've written a memoir, I'm sure you dealt with that in that writing as well, is how memories can mix with assumptions and become myths as you look back on them. We develop our own legends, and how that family dynamic can be affected by that. And I have a sibling, and sometimes when we talk about our childhood, it's stunning that our memories of the same scene can be so different. And then I realized that, you know, you bring your own perspective, your own personality, and some memories are not real. How did you use that in your book? Because I saw some of that where some of the memories seem to be based on assumptions. And then as the story goes on, the mother talking to the twins corrects them here and there. Well, that's not exactly how you remember it.
Right. But I think the reader doesn't really know whose version is correct.
Right.
You know, there's the mother's version. And then once the twins become separate, have separate voices, they also have separate versions. And I think that's how life works, like you said, with your own sibling. So I wanted to reflect that. And I think the more we kind of hold on to a memory, it's like we polish it, and it just gets more and more real to us, and we're less willing to let go of it if someone else challenges it. But yeah, the structure of this is two adults looking back on their childhood. And they're looking for something. They're looking for clues. But they also find other things that they weren't necessarily looking for. And I think that one of the things that I kind of get from this story and get from the idea that our memories are sometimes fallible is to be more open-minded and to not be so sure that I really know what happened. And for instance, if I feel like I want to hold a grudge against someone for something, I think, well, no, maybe it didn't actually happen that way. And it actually kind of lightens the burden of I think, what we have to carry as memories if we question and allow ourselves the possibility that maybe we remember something differently than other people do.
You know, it was years ago, and I won't be able to cite it exactly, but I read some kind of a scientific study that the more frequently we recall a memory, each time it comes up in our mind, it gets a little more corrupted.
Yeah, like the game of telephone.
Yeah, it's just fascinating.
And then we're really just remembering that memory.
Right. And you're remembering it as a different person. You're never the same. It's kind of like you can't step in the same river twice, as they say.
Right.
You're never the same person remembering something. So that in itself, I think, can corrupt a memory.
Yeah. And these two girls, they make a decision when they go off to college not to speak to their father again. And so they have all kinds of motivations to justify doing that. And so that colors how they remember things, too.
Hmm. And then as they, that relationship with their father that later in the book culminates, I suppose, with his funeral and the conversations they have with their mother, and actually throughout, not just in that area of the book, but throughout, they have so many mixed emotions about this abusive parent. They see him as a godlike figure at times. They seem to respect him, and at the same time, he scares the crap out of them. And in their memories, he beats them and all kinds of horrible things. So it's interesting that you take him on as such a complex character, that he's good and bad both, and all the shades between in their eyes.
Yeah, it was important for me to have him be a rounded character and not just a villain, because that's, I think, most people are not just one thing. And often, I think we tend to just look at the thing that justifies our behavior. Yeah, I think he's also, I wanted to make him a magnetic and compelling character, someone that inspired awe and also fear, but kind of both at the same time.
Yeah.
And then also the twins actually, rebel against what he wants them to do with their lives, what he thinks their destiny is. But then in the end, they kind of embrace it too and embrace it, that they have a certain power too. That they've inherited from him, so they do have some of his legacy, and they have to grapple with that too, and their own cruelty.
And at that funeral, they are surprised to see that someone that they grew to hate, if that's a fair word, actually drew a lot of people. And that's yet another facet. Your family sees you in a different way and knows you in a different way than people outside of your family do. He drew a lot of people to his funeral.
Yeah, I have heard many stories from people about this phenomenon of a family member refusing to talk to someone. And sometimes it lasts for many, many years. And I know that it causes a lot of pain to those who are cut off. In a lot of cases, I think the person who does the cutting off tends to portray the person who he's cutting off as a villain. Because otherwise, what justifies such actions? And to reduce that person to only the bad things that person has ever done. And so I'm partly trying to reflect on that, too.
And at some point they say to Mom that you didn't protect us. And Mom responds, how would you have learned to protect yourselves? Towards the end of the book, she keeps kind of turning around and giving another facet to how they see things. And she seems to go from a weak and submissive figure towards the end of the book as a much stronger figure.
Yeah, again, the sisters see her in a certain way because it fits the story that they tell about their father being a villain and their mother being a victim. But then at the end, I actually want the reader to see all the different versions and to have it be a thought-provoking experience so the reader can think for herself what she thinks is true, what parts of what story is true, what feels the truest.
And you won the support of one of our much-loved local authors, Bonnie Jo Campbell. That kind of helped launch this book. Talk about that.
I love Bonnie Jo Campbell's work. She's definitely one of my favorite writers. How it happened was I entered my manuscript into a contest sponsored by AWP, Association for Writers and Writing Programs, for the best novel manuscript of the year. and she was the judge, and it was the finalist. So she actually called me and told me how much she loved the book and said she'd like to write a blurb. And so that was really thrilling.
And then you've entered the challenges of launching a book during the COVID-19 pandemic. Not the way we usually get to launch books, with celebrations and parties and people gathering together. Did that affect your, or perhaps your publisher's, decision on when to launch the book? Or how did you decide to launch the book?
So I know that some books have been postponed. But this book was always planned to release in June. And I don't know, now it's looking like it's not clear when bookstores are going to reopen and when big in-person events are going to happen. So yeah, everybody has had to just pivot differently. And I think in-person events, like the one that I'm going to have, it's going to be online. So I've done a number of those. And you just have to try to engage with the audience in a different way, because they're not there in front of you. And so they ask questions through chat, and I try to show some photos and introduce people to my dog. It's, I think we're all trying to just figure out a way to warm up this in electronic experience that can feel kind of cold.
So tell us a little bit more, Sharon, as you talk about that, about what people can expect at the Michigan News Agency event on August 5th, because it is a virtual reading. We're doing this in a very different way. It's a Zoom event. So what can people expect? How do they participate?
So it will be a Zoom meeting. People, Dean, the owner of the bookstore, will send people a link, and they can just follow the link. And then she will introduce me, and I'll read a little bit from the book and talk about the structure and how it grew into what it grew into. I'll show some pictures, like some pictures of my brother and me when we were five, some pictures of my five-year-old nieces, who actually, when I was reading the book, because they were born around the time my twins were in 2000, I was really thinking of them as I was writing these children and about the world that they live in. So I'll show pictures of them. I will actually, yes, show my dog. And play a little video, which tells the story behind the story about how these twins, their voice breaks into, and metaphorically. And a few months ago, when my book was about to launch, my voice literally broke into, and then one of my vocal cords became paralyzed. It's okay now. You can hear me. Mm. But that was a little bit of life imitating art. So I'll give some behind the scenes, and I'll take questions from audience participants, and I'm happy to answer anything about the book, about writing in general, about publishing in general. I get lots of different kinds of questions. I'm happy to take them all.
Well, the positive side is, folks, you can listen to this reading in your jammies with a glass of wine and never have to leave home and still meet Sharon.
Yeah, and it'll be short, too.
Thank you for taking time to talk with us, Sharon. And the book is Half, and the reading is Wednesday, August 5th from 8 to 8:40 p.m. So get in touch with our beloved Dean at Michigan News Agency, and she'll guide you through how to join in. Thank you, Sharon.
Oh, thank you so much, Cinta.